This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge, and our email address is talk@talklouisiana.org. We are slated to hear from David Rode, a two-time Pulitzer winner who's written a compelling book about American government, and when we get with him, we will. But until then, it is one of those times in which we will review what's happening in our world as we prepare for the show. And Caitlin Joshua is also going to be with us today. She is the young activist from Baton Rouge who was front and center first day of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. The Dems met in Chicago for the first time since 1968. And like 1968, they nominated a candidate who had not entered any of the primaries, Kamala Harris in 2024 and Hubert Horatio Humphrey, the pride of LSU, in 1968. Humphrey lost a close one. It was by about 100,000 votes in the overall vote to Richard Nixon. It wasn't that close in the Electoral College, but it still was close. And the question in that race is who George Wallace hurt more. Did he hurt Richard Nixon or did he hurt Hubert Humphrey? His politics were closer to Nixon's, but in those days, the South was fertile territory for Democrats, and George Wallace carried several Southern states, including Louisiana, Arkansas, Alabama. He carried, I believe, six states overall, also carried Georgia. And Georgia, as we know now, is a state that is purple and may be leaning blue. The population shift is such in Atlanta, which is, of course, more than half the population in that state when you consider metro area, that Georgia is now the only state in the Southeastern Conference of the 12 that is up for grabs. Florida used to be, but Florida is likely to go for Donald Trump, as will all the other states in the Southeastern Conference. And as been noted on this show, those states collectively have 160 electoral votes. And if Donald Trump were to sweep the SEC as he did in 2016 and almost did in 2020, he would only need 110 of the remaining votes to win, meaning that Kamala Harris has very little margin for error. Right now, she's riding high in the polls, but she is not a sure thing at all. But the Real Clear Politics, in the latest review, 10 weeks from Election Day, has the overall odds, the betting odds, Harris 50.5 and Trump 48.0. And that brings us to David Rode, two-time Pulitzer winner, man who has covered national politics and government for a generation, the author of In Deep and three other books, national security editor at NBC and executive editor of the New Yorker website at where he has written about the Justice Department. And that is the focus, part of the focus of his latest book, Where Tyranny Begins, the Justice Department, the FBI, and the War on Democracy. Good morning, David.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Fine. Well, what do you view as this catastrophe that you believe is in the midst as far as how the Justice Department and the FBI have gone rogue?
And thank you, Jim, so much for having me on today. In the book, I found that the problem isn't so much that the Justice Department and FBI have gone rogue. It's more that our kind of hyper-partisanship are pushing, you know, the Justice Department and the FBI to kind of solve our political differences is sort of causing less trust in either department. I think that, you know, we need to have public trust in sort of some basic elements of, you know, our democracy. We need sort of nonpartisan public servants to be election clerks and count votes in an honest and fair way. We need judges to sort of decide cases in an honest and fair way. We need school teachers to be sort of apolitical. So the book's really about the kind of career people who've worked in the FBI and the Justice Department for years and their sense that kind of whatever they do, they're sort of attacked by both parties.
Well, you have outlined how the former president, Donald Trump, used coercion, some might call threats, to bend the DOJ and the FBI to his will. Is that overplayed, or is there a real case to be made that he has pressured many people, including Merrick Garland, the current attorney general, who, of course, was a guy who was nominated to the Supreme Court, but some have said he's not nearly as forceful as he should be?
Yeah, this is the challenge or the problem. I mean, I found there was some things that Trump did that, you know, he was the democratically elected president, and he had a mandate, and the mandate of all government workers is to carry out the policies of a duly elected president. If a president wants to have the Justice Department and the FBI crack down on violent crime, that's absolutely fine. If the president wants to have them crack down on, you know, environmental pollution, that's fine too. The issue is when a president directs the Justice Department to sort of investigate their enemies or go easy on their friends. And Trump was deeply frustrated, you know, with the Trump-Russia investigation. And he pressured, you know, Jeff Sessions, his attorney general, to not recuse himself from that investigation. It was an investigation of the Trump campaign. Sessions was part of that campaign. Folks have heard all this stuff from, you know, for years now. But it was the amount of pressure that Trump put on Sessions to try to get in and kill the investigation, you know, was unusual. There was a debate about whether it was illegal. And the irony is that the Mueller investigation in the end did not find any direct coordination between the Trump campaign and the and Russia. So the system sort of worked, but in the process, many, you know, liberals thought that Trump got away with colluding with Russia. Republicans felt that Trump was the victim of this completely unjust investigation. And I guess that's back to my argument about this kind of hyper-partisanship and hyperbole, that is eating away at public trust in these two institutions.
Our guest is David Rode, two-time winner of the Pulitzer, author of his latest work, Where Tyranny Begins, The Justice Department, the FBI, and the War on Democracy. Now, Donald Trump, of course, is on the ballot in 70 days, and he will likely try to appoint an attorney general who is more like his last one, Mr. Barr. Actually, that wasn't his last one, but it was the one who held the most time, and he didn't like Jeff Sessions. And Sessions was a card-carrying conservative who gave up a U.S. Senate seat to join the Trump administration. How much should the president be involved in what the attorney general does?
I think it should be, you know, limited in the ways I kind of described earlier. The kind of modern office of attorney general emerged after Watergate. The problem there was that the attorney general, John Mitchell, under President Nixon, used the office of the attorney general to sort of investigate groups that were seen as enemies of President Nixon, sort of Vietnam War protesters and black nationalist groups. He also, you know, while attorney general, investigated leaks of damaging information by the president. So this is 50 years ago now. There was this many changes made to the Justice Department after Watergate, and that was to have, again, this model of it, and it's a kind of a tough job because, again, the attorney general works for the president, carries out the president's policies. But then if there is possible wrongdoing or illegalities by the president or his aides, the attorney general is supposed to investigate it. And that's how we started out having independent counsels, special counsels, appointed to oversee these cases. So, the idea is that the department is supposed to apply the law equally to all Americans. It's just getting harder and harder. Another mm-hmm. example I'd mention is the investigation. So Merrick Garland, you know, was more of a traditionalist, and he really believed in that model. And so he appointed Robert Hur as a special counsel to investigate President Biden's handling of documents. And then as part of Hur's final report, he included, he was explaining why he didn't charge Biden with mishandling documents. And he said, it's a famous thing, that you all, everybody's heard, but about, you know, that a trial, President Biden would be seen as like a well-meaning, you know, older man with a memory issue. Democrats in that situation savaged her for putting that in his report, saying it was excessive and partisan and all these things. I mean, he was trying to explain why he didn't bring the case. Her also was criticized by Republicans for not prosecuting Biden. And I guess that's an example, again, of the, and it, look, bluntly, the debate, Trump-Biden debate happened, and it did, you know, I think it's fair to say, become apparent to people that President Biden does have memory issues. So I again, it's this cycle of kind of, I think her did a good job. I think Robert Mueller did a good job.
All right. Well, we will return and spend a few more minutes after this 89.3 second timeout with David Rode, two-time Pulitzer winner. This is Jim Inkster. Thanks for joining us for Talk Louisiana. In short order, we're going to hear from Caitlin Joshua. We'll also check in with her twin, Angel Bradford. They're both activists, and Caitlin was speaking at the Democratic National Convention a week ago, so we will get her take about that experience and the issue that she is intricately involved in. But we're spending a few minutes with David Rode, a compelling book, Where Tyranny Begins, The Justice Department, the FBI, and the War on Democracy is the book. David's a two-time Pulitzer winner, and he is the national security editor at NBC News. And a listener asked a cogent question about James Comey, since the book focuses also on the FBI. He may very well have cost Hillary Clinton the 2020 election, but Donald Trump didn't like him and got rid of him and got away with it. That was an unusual move, too. Most presidents would never have just outright fired the FBI agent because they woke up one morning and said he's got to go, but that's what happened, isn't it?
That is what happened, and that's it's a great question from the listener, Jim, Comey announced that he was reopening the, you know, investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails, you know, a few days before the 2016 election, and it did sway the race, according to opinion polls, towards Trump. He did that. I spoke to someone very close to Comey who also approved that decision because he had promised Congress he would tell them if there were any developments in the investigation. They found this new tranche of emails of Clinton's, and, you know, they were, what I found is that Comey and others were sort of biased towards their institution more than they were biased in a partisan way. So he wanted to defend the institution of the FBI and keep his promise. And so he made that announcement, and it sort of blew up and swayed an election, which I don't think he intended. And then Trump comes in and fires him. And so there was a basic fear among presidents since Watergate, both Republicans and Democrats, that, you know, firing an FBI director, fighting an independent counsel would get, you know, would force a president to resign as Nixon was forced to resign. And Trump did that. He fought back, and he wasn't forced to resign. He was impeached, you know, twice, and we can talk about all that, but and so it's a sort of uncharted territory we're in now. And then, you now have the prosecutions of Trump, which, you know, there's a debate fiercely again about whether they're fair or not. January 6th was a serious thing. I think it's not clear what happened then in terms of Trump's own role. But again, it's this, I find that the institutions sort of function, the most average career people are trying to, you know, carry out the, you know, lawful policies of the elected president. They're not part of a secret cabal trying to help Democrats or Republicans.
Robin Dow says we've got time for one call for David Rode. Please be brief. Jason in Jones Creek, you're the caller Robin has chosen. Jason, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Yes, good morning, Jim. Yeah, I was wondering how the recent presidential immunity ruling might affect how any president going forward is going to be able to use the Justice Department.
All right. What about the Supreme Court ruling on immunity for presidents?
It has an enormous impact. Many people were surprised by the breadth of the ruling. It specifically says that any conversation between the president and the attorney general can't be used in a criminal investigation. It says that all of it is absolutely immune. So I had a former Justice Department official tell me that if a president, talks about, we're going to sit down together and, talk about breaking in the Democratic National Committee headquarters, obviously a reference to Watergate, the president talking to his attorney general about it, that conversation can't be used, in a criminal investigation. Mm-hmm. So that's such a sweeping ruling that it does, I think, create the potential for abuse by a Democratic or Republican president. There are some sort of conservative legal scholars who think that the Watergate reforms went too far. The presidency had been too weakened. So I think this was an effort by conservatives on the Supreme Court to strengthen the presidency, to let the president order his, attorney general to do things. And Bill Barr had a view that if you feel a president is misusing the attorney general, the DOJ, the FBI, then voters can vote out that president after 4 years. And that's where the issue should be addressed. Mm-hmm. But it was a sweeping ruling.
Congrats on your fine book, Where Tyranny Begins, David Rode. Pleasure being with you this morning. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Tim.
And we're joined now in studio by Caitlin Joshua, and her sister, Angel Bradford, is joining us telephonically. And they both are young activists, and they both are left of center as far as their politics. But last week, Caitlin, who's been making the round, she's on many national programs. She has quite a compelling story that was presented on the first day with her on stage in Chicago telling about what happened when she was 11 weeks pregnant. She started miscarrying in the fall of 2022, a few months after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade and triggered Louisiana's near total abortion ban. And for those who haven't heard the story, she is here to tell this and more. And let's begin there. That 2 years ago is something that has shaped your life and has made you an activist. And I'm sure that time is still quite vivid mm-hmm. for you, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's hard to say that it's already going to be 2 years in a couple weeks. And again, Jim, thanks for having me. I do appreciate that. So my story begins in the fall of 2022 when I found myself in a healthcare crisis here in Baton Rouge. My husband and I were previously excited and over the moon. We had found out that I was expecting. And right around 4 weeks, I actually called my provider's office because that was the time that I went in with my daughter, who's now almost six. And I asked them, hey, can I get an appointment to see my physician? I'm pretty sure I'm expecting. I'm pretty sure I'm pregnant. And was told by multiple providers that they were not seeing patients until the 12-week mark, which to me was a little odd. And so I asked candidly to the front desk medical assistant, what's going on here? Why aren't y'all seeing patients? It's not because of the ban, right? And she candidly stated that it was because of the ban. Providers were seeing patients later to mitigate some of that legal liability that comes with seeing patients in that first 12 weeks. And so from the very start, I saw that direct impact of what the ban had done in our state. But never thought in a million years I'd find myself a few weeks later unable to get care. I went to two hospitals here in Baton Rouge area seeking help at 11 weeks. I know the standard protocol for 11 weeks, almost 12 weeks, is a DNC procedure, which technically is an abortion. But unfortunately, providers were not providing that at that time. I'm told up until a couple weeks ago, someone had reached out to me on social that in some ways and in some areas of the state, they're still not providing that care. And it's because mm-hmm. of the ban. And my message has been very loud and clear. The inability for people to be able to have access to abortion health care can be life-threatening. It could potentially, find you in a situation similar to mine or worse at death's door, which the other two ladies on the stage with me kind of gave some retrospect into that situation. But all in all, the ban that we have on the books is dangerous. It needs to be clarified, and the vague language has got to go.
877-217-5757 if you'd like to engage Caitlin Joshua. And as mentioned, we will be joined by her sister, who cannot be here. She's with her husband, who's having some health challenges and is on the way back from New Orleans. But what happened at 11 weeks?
11 weeks, I experienced pain worse than childbirth. I've had two babies at this point, though they were not easy labor and deliveries, they were nothing compared to that miscarriage. I was bleeding profusely. My husband was extremely nervous for 5 days on end, where I just could not get relief. I was told to take Tylenol, which, you know, seems like the easy thing to do, but at that time it was not providing any type of relief for me. And so I had to literally manage and navigate a miscarriage. What I like to say old style, right? Like old school, just back in the day when there were no medications available for women that were dealing with miscarriage. And to be that far along and unable to get the procedure that I know I deserved was the most hurtful part. And so it took me a couple months to pass my pregnancy without dignity by myself. And it helped me see firsthand why so many Black women are dying at alarming rates in our state.
877-217-5757. We do have to take a short break, but we will return with Caitlin Joshua. She spoke on stage, first day, Democratic National Convention at the United Center 8 nights ago in the great city of Chicago, and she'll be here, and we'll also hear from her fabulous twin, Angele Bradford, right after this time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, Robin Dow producing, and our guest is Caitlin Joshua in studio, and soon we'll be joined by her twin, Angele Bradford. But your number, if you'd like to join the conversation in our remaining time with them, is 877-217-5757. I ran into Renee Smith this morning at Louis, Center of the Universe, at 7:30 in the morning. She told me that you... started organizing at 2042 Georgia Street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure did.
In the bottom, right?
In the bottom, yeah. We were in the trenches organizing communities around voting.
A few years ago,
yeah.
And now you're speaking at the Democratic National Convention, and soon you'll go on the road for the Harris campaign.
Yeah.
And the election is 10 weeks away. And they're really focusing on Georgia, aren't they?
They are.
They got a shot.
Yeah, they think they have a shot. And pulling Georgia and trying to get it to go blue for this election.
So what's the next move on the campaign trail?
Yeah, certainly. So we'll go back out. Amanda Zaraski of Texas and myself will go to several battleground states to talk about our personal stories and the importance of reproductive health care in this country and how all 50 states should be afforded the opportunity to have access to this life-saving health care, not just some states. As we know, 22 abortion bans exist in our country, and Kamala Harris has been very front and center on this issue and has really centered the concerns of reproductive health care. And so we're going to back her up, and we're going to do what we can to make sure that folks understand and are connecting the dots, if you will, because I think there's still very much this narrative portrayed by right-wingers that we are advocating for the murder of babies or we are advocating against the potential of life, and that's simply not the case. We are pro-life. We are advocating for more women to have access to be able to save themselves and be able to, you know, be here for their families and their communities. And I think that's just as important.
Well, last Friday, Donald Trump on Truth Social wrote, "My administration will be great for women and their reproductive rights." So he's trying to be pro-choice now. Mm-hmm. So I'd imagine these, quote, pro-lifers, they're all dressed up and no place to go. One of these people's going to be president. And Trump says, at least through his vice president, that he would veto a national ban on abortion. Do you believe that?
I do not. And I've said this multiple times. Trump has flip-flopped on this issue too many times as a result of his ability to influence the Roe v. Wade decision and overturn and bragging about it, right? He's done a great job of telling folks that he is proud, and it is a beautiful thing to watch America have to, succumb to the abortion bans in the 22 states. And for him, that is something that he's proud of. And I don't think that's going to change overnight, and I don't believe for one second that he's walking back on this issue.
But it's a dead heat race. Donald Trump is almost certain to carry Louisiana. By the way, I was looking, and I've got to go back, but I looked at the election of 2016, 2020, even 2012, and in 2008. In the last four elections, not only has Louisiana gone almost identical with the Democrat getting around 40 and the Republican getting 58-59, but all 64 parishes have voted identically. All 64 wow. parishes have voted identically in the last four presidential elections. So that means East Baton Rouge Parish is going to go blue, but the state is going to go red. Well, I love this line from Maureen Dowd, who can, of course, do the artful dodge with great gusto. She says, Trump, who just got endorsed by Bobby Kennedy, former guest on this show, Robert Kennedy Jr., says his motto should be, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for me." That should be a lot of politicians' motto,
right? I agree,
right?
Yeah.
And, of course, what they want you to do is vote for them. And Kamala Harris once said as well, the election is 10 weeks away, and we hope no matter who you're for or against, you'll vote. Let's go to your – before we go to the phone lines, quickly I want to get your partner in activism, and Angel Bradford, who is your twin. And, Angel, I know you wanted to be here, but – your thoughts about your sister's sudden rise to fame and the role that she and others like her, including you, will play in this campaign.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for having me. And I'm just proud of Kate. Like, our entire family's been really proud of Kate. And it's been, you know, all 2 years in the making of just seeing her tour with the hopefully to be president, Kamala Harris, and before that with President Biden, really, you know, doing all the stump speeches and connecting with women and families around the country around this issue. So I think, Kate, in a lot of ways, you've brought this issue back to the forefront because there are plenty of different things that are the focus right now across the country, including economy. But this is a part of that larger conversation around economy and family stability and finances. And so, yeah, I'm super excited about the fall. I'm looking forward to all the good work that's going to happen to base build in the Deep South in particular, because I want to look ahead beyond just this election cycle and one day get Louisiana to Georgia.
Well, right now in the seven states considered swing states, and North Carolina has moved into that category as well, every one of them is within the margin of error. Every one of them. Now, Donald Trump does lead in five of the seven, but his biggest lead is 1.4 points, and that's in Nevada. Now, Harris leads in Wisconsin and Michigan, and she leads now by two points in Michigan, 2.0, so that's the biggest lead of any of the seven. But Pennsylvania, which likely will determine who wins the presidency, Donald Trump's ahead by 0.2 points, 0.2. Let's go to Miriam in Mandeville. Miriam, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I am so sorry that your guest had to experience much worse maternal care than I personally experienced with my two pregnancies in Baton Rouge in the 1980s, early 80s. I am so sorry. I want to know, does your guest think that this Republican war on women is due to ignorance about women's, you know, reproductive organs and how they work? Or is it more to control and disempower women? Or is it just about the cruelty? Or is it racial?
All right. You gave Caitlin a lot to chew on there, but what are the reasons why you and Miriam and others believe that women are getting the shaft when it comes to reproductive rights? Your thoughts.
And Miriam, thank you for calling in, and I appreciate the empathy. I have to believe it's not rooted in ignorance, y'all, and I wanted to believe that so badly. But the opportunities I've had to engage with a great deal of Republican Party leaders in the state of Louisiana has led me to believe that it is not about the harm or the danger for the woman. It is all about lifting up the concern and the rights of the baby, of the fetus. And I think we need to understand that we can walk and chew gum here. We can have policies that put in place where, as they say, abortion on demand is not available, right, in a very irresponsible way. But we can certainly uplift policies and put in place laws that protect women and make sure that we are not furthering the terrible rates of maternal morbidity rates that we already have in the state of Louisiana. And so I think until we can get people in office that are willing to have that conversation and understand that we've got to position women, again, my sister just called in and spoke about how this also talks about the larger conversation of economy, right? If you've got families that are whole, women that are here, women that are able to go to work and are not, you know, suffering as a result of an abortion ban, which in the long run does cause a lot of different issues as it relates to the economy, then we are making Louisiana families whole. And so I think until we have people in office that want to have those conversations, we just can't go back and forth and continue with the political game that is happening in our state legislature and down from our governor.
877-217-5757 is your number. Patricia in Magnolia Woods. Patricia, you're on with Caitlin and Angel. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning. And thank you so much for sharing your story nationwide. I'm sorry you had to go through that.
Thank you.
My question is, the Louisiana, according to the CDC, Louisiana has the fifth worst maternal death rate in the nation, whereas California is much, much better. And so, and the CDC says that healthcare through pregnancy is one of the most important things to prevent maternal death. I was wondering if, you know, Louisiana, there are a lot of people in Louisiana are pro-life, but I was wondering if you know if Governor Landry and the state government are doing anything to improve maternal health care.
I don't want to speak, you know, ignorantly. I know that I've gone to that state legislative session 2 years in a row to advocate for policies that would clear up the vague language within our abortion ban, which we know per studies that came out this spring is already having a major effect on maternal health care rates in our state and is worsening them, right? In terms of what we can do, I won't say that the governor has done a great job on this issue, and I do plan on reaching out to him to try and sit down and have a conversation about this and see if we can get, you know, at least meet halfway on the issue of maternal health care in our state. But for now, that has not happened. I know LDH, Louisiana Department of Health, is doing a wonderful job of trying to uplift within the 64 parishes the issues on a very small scale. And I think that's something that we can look forward to and hoping that our science community can do what they can to uplift those concerns. But at large, with our governor's administration, I've not seen anything progressive that would, in fact, improve the quality of life or the quality of care that we're receiving as pregnant women in our state.
Skipper in Gonzales. Skipper, good morning.
Yes, I appreciate you taking the call. And as everyone is, I'm sorry for what you had to go through with that type of medical care. I was wondering, the problem I've struggled with my whole life is when does life actually begin in the womb and it becomes the sanctity of life? That is the toughest decision I have because I want women to have rights, but I also want that child, and I've watched my grandbabies be born. And
all right. What about when life begins, at least the life that we want to protect above all other considerations? Does it begin at one trimester, two trimesters? Does it begin at birth? And should doctors have the ultimate authority over whether to make a move in a troubled pregnancy? Those are all the questions on the table. What about rape and incest? All of those are in play, but some people believe that abortion is death and it should be stopped at any cost.
Yeah, and what I say to that, kind of what you just said, Jim, I think the conversation has to be had between the provider and the patient. We have taken that away, that autonomy and that ability for doctors to use their spirit of discernment and their expertise and their training that they went to school for to decide that. And so for me, I'm all about taking it out of the sphere of politics and putting it back where it belongs, which is within healthcare community.
Well, we'll be back and spend a few more minutes with Caitlin Joshua and Angel Bradford, her sister, who could not be in studio, but she's on the road, and we'll get some final thoughts from them, and we'll take a call or two in our remaining time with them. And then we'll hear from Ronna Gray. It was 10 years ago today that Scott Rogers, the flamboyant television personality from England who made Baton Rouge his home, ordered his own murder-suicide. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Caitlin Joshua, and also we'll hear again from Angel Bradford. But please be brief. We're going to try to get to as many of you as we can, but we need you to ask your question immediately. Patrick in Indiswald Estates. Patrick, you're on. Good morning, sir.
Hey, so I got a question. How long have you been a political activist? I see you were once a member of Step Up Louisiana.
All right. What about
Yeah, I'll
your
be
activism?
Quick. Oh, yeah, certainly. So I have been a organizer as my career for about 6 years now. It was with Step Up Louisiana, Power Coalition, did some work with Earthworks, an environmental justice organization. Never have I touched reproductive health care until my own lived experience. And so I've been blessed enough to be able to, you know, kind of leave behind some of the organizing and be able to center reproductive health care in my personal capacity.
Melanie in Hundred Oaks. Melanie, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, great appreciation for Angel and Kate for your activism for many years. And so if you could each tell us on the Louisiana level and maybe national level, what are the most important things we can do to support Black maternal health?
All right.
Yeah, I'll start. On the state level, absolutely keep pressuring our lawmakers that we're stuck with for now, our lawmakers to be able to make better decisions around the law. We are simply asking for the most basic level of maternal health care in our state, and we know that the law as it reads is confusing for for physicians, excuse me, over 300 physicians signed a letter 3-4 months ago during the last legislative session asking and begging the legislature not to pass more egregious bills and laws that prevent them from being able to do their jobs. That is only going to put Black women at the forefront of these of this impact. Right. And so the least we can do is as have them clarify up the vague language within the law and be able to do more around the current laws that are on the books. And then, of course, like do more studies, do more, centering Black maternal health care in as many ways as we possibly can during legislative session and making that something that's carried out 365. All right.
Angel, I want to get your take. Melanie asked for your thoughts.
Yeah, I can be quick. So for the state, I'm focusing on redistricting. So state legislature still hasn't redrawn their lines. Some of those legislatures says some of those legislators should not be in those particular districts because they are way too gerrymandered. So really pressuring legislators and leaders on the different committees to redraw the lines. And then on the national level, I think just continuing the conversation around healthcare, our nation still has a lot to fix on the healthcare front, and we can't stop at the Affordable Healthcare Act.
Okay. Final caller for Angel and Caitlin, James and Metairie. James, you're on.
Jim, I hope this is relevant, but I'd like to get your guest's opinion on the most absurd ruling by the Alabama Supreme Court earlier this year that frozen embryos are legally children.
All right.
Yeah, that was a hard one. And I'll say this firsthand. Amanda Zaraskiet of Texas, who I travel with most times, I watched as her and her husband, which the only way they can carry children, bring children into the world, is through IVF. I know so many friends, so many family members. Y'all know so many friends and family members or people that you know that were directly impacted as a result of that IVF decision. And we're watching a complete terror, thinking that other states would do the same thing. But I think we need to use that as an example of what could potentially happen if we allow Donald Trump to get back into that White House, if we allow the MAGA Republicans to do what they say they've been doing, wanting to do since day one. Project 2025 is very real. That is in there. IVF is definitely on the ballot this fall. So do what you can to make sure that you're not voting against that.
Well, thank you for your appearance, and hopefully we'll have you and your sister back in studio together, who together at 32 are conquering the world. So keep going.
Trying.
Virus, so.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Angel. Soon. Thank you.
Thank
Be
you.
Be safe and see you soon. And we're joined in studio now by Ronna Gray, the author of Familiar Evil. By the way, I know Caitlin worked in the LSU football office at one
yes.
time, didn't
Best
you?
Job I ever had. Can they have me back? That's a better job.
As did Robin Dow, our producer. Oh, yeah. And Ronna was the number two to person in the department.
Moons ago.
Yeah, when LSU was winning more championships than it's ever won. Joe Dean won more championships than all the athletic
directors. Oh, really?
Yes,
oh,
he did. Yes,
you know
he did.
That.
And you know what? He didn't get a $500,000 bonus every
that's
time
right,
they won
That's
one,
right.
Which the current athletic director gets.
Amazing.
Joe would, as I wrote in Tiger Ag, they should give it to his estate.
That's right.
But anyway, we're talking about Familiar Evil, her book, which still has relevance. 10 years ago today, and a listener said, how does somebody order their own murder-suicide? Well, I guess it's more like arranged his murder and suicide of his
Definitely orchestrated
companion,
it.
Companion and his son-in-law. This
right.
was an unusual family unit, shall
yes,
we say.
They what? Definitely put it into action. And, of course, he approached another young man living in the house with the offer first, let's go lie down and shoot each other in the heart.
In and the nude, right?
He declined. I don't know about that. He declined. And then he put this in motion, and it's the only notarized suicide note I've ever heard of, but they went to an attorney and wrote out all their passwords to their accounts.
And an attorney was okay with this?
I guess. You'd have to ask him. I mean, he'll be on your show next.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
And who he wanted his adopted children to go to. None of that was legal, of course. They went back into child services. But very much put it in motion himself, which is not really unusual, Jim. Child predators are basically cowards. Their victims are children, and, once they're confronted, they're narcissists. Once they're confronted, they're losing control. They know that. Often they choose suicide.
Well, it was on this date, August 27, 2014, police discovered Scott Rogers, 52, fatally shot in bed at his St. Gabriel home. Nearby lay Matthew Hodgkinson, 36, unconscious, also suffering a gunshot wound. Investigators theorized that Hodgkinson had fired a single bullet into Rogers' head and then attempted to take his own life. He died at the hospital more than a week later. Now, This was a story that has been covered now by national and international media. Robin Dow has found from one of those documentaries the actual, I think this is a 911 call from the house. Robin, can we hear it?
I just heard like a detonation. I just heard another noise. Oh my God. And who's upstairs that could have detonated something? Yes, there is a Scott Rogers.
All right.
Yes,
few sound effects in there, but still you get the idea. And that poor lady who was one of those who was a victim, she was trapped in this.
And as you can hear, she speaks with an accent. She's saying a detonation.
Right.
Where we would have said a gunshot or something. She's saying, I just heard a detonation.
Well, Scott Rogers was a man about town. His program was called Around Town, and he was a guest on this show, and I was a guest on his show. And he took Baton Rouge by storm. And in those days, before social media really became prominent, you could be public and not be known outside your own little world. And he pulled that off pretty effectively for a while.
He had a very generic website and wouldn't allow any of the people living under his control to have social media accounts, which you're right, were very new at the time. I also want to say that same day, what comes to my mind, the shock, of course, of the murder and suicide taking place, was that so many community people were going on television saying what a great loss this was, what a fine, upstanding person he was.
And we were
encouraged to get information out quickly to the contrary. And, of course, I called you. It was the best source of reliable information. And I ran into Dane Sherman, who's a guest on your show occasionally, Saturday night at a book signing, and he said the following morning was the most riveting hour of radio he's ever heard. Well, and I couldn't agree more, and I hear it everywhere I go, when you interviewed those adult victims of his abuse.
Well, Scott Rogers took this town by storm, and I must say I liked the guy, but I didn't know about his past until about a year before all this broke out. I found out through Rana about his problems in England, but if not for that, which he was going to great lengths to keep secret, he might have been governor of Louisiana. You know, he was the chaplain. Do you think this guy was the chaplain for the sheriff's office?
He's Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff, right.
And he was the spokesperson for the Better Business Bureau. He had some charisma, didn't he?
And he won an award from DCFS for being a model advocate for foster parents and adoption, because he was that's the thing a lot of people don't remember. He was adopting children from child services, which was the real danger there.
And it's all detailed in the book Familiar Evil, which has stood up well. And 10 years later, this is probably the only acknowledgement of what happened on that day. But it was not only the talk of Baton Rouge, it was the talk of the nation.
It was, and it jumped the Atlantic over to England and was the talk of the town in London because of his trial there.
And a listener asked a question, which you've detailed on this show, but it's worth doing so again. How did you find out about his sinister past?
Very quickly, I was contacted by one of his abuse survivors who found a letter to the editor, so don't ever write those off as being insignificant. I wrote one and mentioned his name. It took 3 years after I wrote that, but he found my letter to the editor online and reached out to me to tell me how dangerous he was and about his past in England.
And Scott knew the authorities were on to him, and that's why he did this, didn't he?
Yes. Some of the people had been called before a grand jury because, as a lot of people know, of course, there were two children living in the home with him, which was the real threat. But usually you catch people on other things like lying to get citizenship, things like that.
Well, in retrospect, I don't know how many people have said, I knew that guy was no good from the start, but I knew he was unusual, but I had no idea about this.
Right.
And I, as I said, I personally, he was in the business of making people like him.
Yeah. Well, there's been three network documentaries made on it, and we're hoping for a series. So you're right. The story continues.
Familiar Evils, the book from Rhonda Gray. And we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, stay safe and stay tuned.